It's 10:06 on a Tuesday. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week here on the Ideas Network. Well, according to a study by the Williams Institute, the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quadrupled in the last 17 years. Well, what does that all mean? Well, that's what we're going to discuss in this hour here on the Ideas Network. We're not only going to talk about the demographics of this, but what happens when these aging gay couples, when they get old? How are their lives going to be any different than anyone else's? We also have a report that in a number of circumstances that gay couples are having difficulty with certain senior services, assisted living facilities, home care, and things. They're encountering prejudice and other problems. And so we're going to kind of discuss all of that this hour. And joining us first by telephone is Gary Gates, Senior Research Fellow of the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law and the author of this study. Good morning, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
What prompted this study in the first place?
Well, it's an extension of work that I've been doing, sort of tracking characteristics of same-sex couples using both the census and now the new American Community Survey data. And the new American Community Survey data now allow us to kind of do this tracking in between decennial census years. So it's just an extension of that work.
So we don't have to wait for another 10-year period to elapse before we can get new numbers.
Right. So, you know, the first time we were able to really measure same-sex couples in the census was 1990, but we had to wait 10 years to get another count. And now with the American Community Survey, we have annual estimates. So it greatly increases our ability to kind of look at trends and, you know, consider any changes happening.
And according to your report, how many same-sex couples or couples reporting themselves as unmarried partners are there in the United States today?
Right now, in the last year, 2006, it was 780,000 same-sex couples.
And that compares to about 145,000 as reported in 1990.
In 1990. So it's actually, I figured out, it's actually a quintupling of the number. So it's grown by, you know, a factor of five.
What accounts for this, or what do you theorize is the reason for the increase?
I think the biggest reason is simply people being more willing to indicate the nature of their relationship on government surveys. I think we have lots of evidence through polls and surveys that acceptance of gay people in general and same-sex couples in particular has grown quite substantially in the United States. We're now at a point, I think a recent LA Times poll had 60% of Americans either supporting marriage or some kind of civil union arrangement for same-sex couples. So, you know, 6 in 10 Americans supporting some kind of legal recognition. That's a dramatic change in the last, say, 15 years since we first started tracking these couples in 1990. So I think that acceptance means that individuals, and particularly individuals who are perhaps not in the coastal areas where acceptance has traditionally been higher, they're now feeling more comfortable in their surroundings, and I think that leads them to be more honest on surveys.
Well, let's talk about where the numbers are really growing, because I was looking at the map that came with your study, and I was quite frankly surprised. It was a little counterintuitive, and perhaps
it said
that, you know, I mean, I was making way too many assumptions. But talk about where the increases have been coming.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that we can do with these data, the question I'm most frequently asked is, you know, how many gay people are there? And whatever answer I give, the next response is, well, you know, how bad is that undercount? Because we know there are people in the closet. And, you know, how many people are in the closet? Well, that's a challenging question to answer because, you know, you're asking me to count people who won't be counted. But what's interesting about the census is, at least retrospectively, we can kind of look at sort of where the closet was and where it's kind of opening the widest. And what you find find is enormous increases and substantially more increases in the most conservative parts of the country. And in fact, there's a fairly strong relationship between the more socially and politically conservative an area was, even going as far back as into the early 90s, the bigger the increase in the number of same-sex couples. And as you said, that seems a little counterintuitive, but I think it's that those are the areas where many, many more people were closeted, and as acceptance has moved from the coasts into the heartland, you've seen this kind of opening of those closet doors.
Joining us now by telephone to talk about another aspect of this phenomenon is Jane Gross, a national reporter for the New York Times and author of an article recently in the New York Times titled "Aging and Gay: Facing Prejudice in Twilight." The existence of gay couples postulates the elderly gay couples and what happens to them then, and that's a topic that we wanted to bring up this hour, and one of the reasons we invited Jane Gross to be with us. She can only be here until 10:30, and so, Jane, good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, John.
What did you find as you were writing your article? What's going on in the elderly gay community?
Well, I think that the thing that I found most striking as a reporter is how oblivious even, you know, the most sensitive, good-hearted, straight person is to what the fears might be of gay people as they reach the point of frailty where they need to be dependent on somebody else. I have to admit that it had really never crossed my mind, for instance, in several years of visiting my mother in a nursing home, to look around and wonder whether any of those people were gay, and if they were, how they had to behave in order to feel safe in that environment.
Well, the current generation is, correct me if I'm wrong, is pretty much the first generation where people have been able to live openly as gay. And so perhaps there are a number of the people who are in at an age now where they're requiring the kinds of care that you talk about in your article. Maybe they weren't out or hadn't come out, and now they're out, and this is becoming something that we have to pay attention to.
Well, I think that's right to a certain extent. I mean, I think that, you know, some enormous but unknown percentage of, you know, say people in their 70s and their 80s were either never out, you know, or out only in that very bifurcated kind of way where, you know, at work and, you know, in your family and in all of those places you were closeted, and in your, you know, social life you were sort of tentatively out. So, and they're also, you know, with good cause, fearful, suspicious, not sure what the reaction is going to be. And so what I found by their own accounts is, you know, given the least bit of feeling vulnerable, as anybody would in, you know, say a skilled nursing facility, their default position is going to be that hiding is safe. And, you know, of course, it's not only that generation of gay people that had a completely different experience growing up. It's also that generation of straight people. I mean, I think at least hypothetically, when it's the post-Stonewall gay men and lesbians who are old enough to need that care, and the baby boomers who were their roommates, it may not be the kind of big deal it is now. But, you know, in this generation, to expect the, you know, straight old people to suddenly feel totally comfortable, for instance, with sharing a room with somebody who's going through a sex change. I mean, that's a lot to ask of somebody who's 80.
800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to call to join our discussion. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, please use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. We're talking about a couple of related topics this morning. Kind of one leads into the other. First of all, there is a recent study that indicates that the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quintupled in the last 17 years. What's that mean? And then also, you know, the whole topic of an aging population, a significant amount of which is now self-identified as being gay, and how does that affect things like senior care and what happens to people as they get older and require more intervention from others and what their thoughts and feelings might be. You can give us a call at 800-486-8655. We have two guests to talk about this issue with us this morning. Jane Gross, a national reporter for The New York Times, is only with us until 10:30. And then Gary Gates, senior research fellow of the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law and the author of the study that prompted this discussion in the first place, is with us for the whole hour. So if you have questions for Jane Gross, now is the time to call. 800-486-8655, 227-2050. Perhaps you have a personal story that you would like to share with us about your own experience. That might be a great reason to call. I'm John Munson, and I'm sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 minutes past 10 o'clock. Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. I did it again. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. I have to remember who I'm subbing for these days. I should maybe wear something around my neck that indicates this. Here's what's coming up later on today on Talk of the Nation. One parent calls it a silent epidemic. His 15-year-old daughter was sexually abused by her teacher, and a recent investigation found more than 2,500 teachers who were punished for sexual misconduct in a four-year period. After one on Talk of the Nation, what we know and what we don't about sexual abuse in schools. That's Talk of the Nation after 1 o'clock today. This hour, we're talking about the growing numbers of people who have identified themselves as gay couples on the one hand, and also what happens now as our entire population is aging and more people are going into healthcare facilities and so forth, assisted living, nursing homes, if you want to call them that, and having home health care. How much prejudice is there still involved in the with how people are treated in terms of those who've identified themselves as gay? We're trying to discuss, wrap our arms around this entire topic, and it's a big job. Fortunately, we've got lots of help, including you. If you call us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or 227-2050. And joining us to discuss these issues this hour, Jane Gross, national reporter for The New York Times, and Gary Gates, a senior research fellow at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. Professor Gates, about how many people over the age of 55 can we say are part of the gay population?
Actually, I'm not sure. I know the number for age 55 and older. My estimate is that it's about 2.4 million Americans are identify as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, and are over age 55.
And that's a considerably higher number than the numbers in your study that identify themselves as same-sex couples.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And that's partly, I'm basing it on an estimate, a population estimate of gay and lesbian people, not just couples. So the estimate is actually to try to capture everybody.
Well, I guess I asked that question to then turn to Jane Gross and ask this other question. There are a lot of people out there who are gay, if these numbers are correct, who are gay and who really aren't connected. They haven't identified themselves as part of being part of a couple. What happens? What kind of support system is there out there for individuals who reach a certain age and who are gay and may not have a partner?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts, and some of them contradictory about that, okay? First of all, the generation that we're talking about, and, you know, I don't mean the active, you know, live on a golf course elderly. I mean people at the stage where they're literally dependent on the kindness of strangers, whether in nursing home or home health attendants or something like that. That age group, I don't know if Gary has data on this, but my anecdotal sense from reporting is that many, if not most of them, have grown children from heterosexual marriages that were very common way to hide in that era. And so sort of ironically, they've got, in many cases, the supports of adult children and a nuclear family in a way that you wouldn't think right from the get-go that they did. They probably don't have the same kind of community support that the younger generation of gay people have, having gone through the AIDS epidemic and taking care of each other in that capacity. The other thing that I meant to mention before but didn't, because I certainly don't want to make it sound as if my sense is that the harsh treatment in these facilities is largely coming from fellow patients, because my gut tells me that that's not the case. But the job force that does those kinds of low-end, sort of not nursing but more custodial care, the person who's likely to be a home health aide, the person who's likely to be a nurse's aide in a nursing home, for instance, many of them come from either religious or ethnic or national backgrounds where their religion bumps right up against, you know, a quote-unquote gay lifestyle. And, you know, they will come into a client's house and, read the Bible to them, call them a sinner, what have you. In a nursing home, they'll refuse to provide certain kind of personal care for somebody. And it was, to me, a very interesting subset of the kind of things that happen when the people providing the hands-on care and the people receiving the hands-on care come from such dramatically different cultural settings.
Is there any effort being made to train workers in how to properly behave?
Yes. There are projects in most of the major cities in the country. They're relatively new. They're generally run either by the gay advocacy organizations, you know, that in another era their kind of primary agenda item was AIDS, and they've shifted their focus to some of these aging issues. And they're often led by people who are professionals in geriatric care, generally who happen themselves to be gay. And, you know, not to take anything away from what they're doing, have an enormous self-interest in getting this fixed before it's their time. And they're running, you know, what's known as cultural competency trainings in residential facilities like nursing homes, among the workforce of home health care agencies. And I don't think that anybody's been doing it for long enough or studied it systematically to actually know anything about whether it works. But, I mean, some of the things that they're being taught are pretty interesting, like trying to figure out the sexual orientation of somebody in this situation who is not inclined to volunteer it right away. And, you know, to try to make sense out of the home health care client who suddenly wants to fire the home health aide but isn't at the start telling you why. I mean, these folks are being taught how to probe in a non-discriminatory way to figure out if indeed, you know, the problem is that the home health aide is praying for their salvation.
I know you have to leave us, so I want to thank you for spending this amount of time with us. We appreciate your insights, and you've given us some things to chew on for the rest of our hour here this morning.
Thank you, John, very much. And I'm sorry to have to bug out early.
Not a problem.
Okay.
It happens all the time.
Thank you very much.
Jane Gross, national reporter for The New York Times, joining us this morning by phone. She had other things that she needed to do. We were lucky to get her for the half hour we did. Well, let's continue our discussion. Gary Gates is still with us, senior research fellow for the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law and the author of a study which indicates that the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quintupled in the last 17 years. And we'll talk about that study and its implications for our society and our culture for the remainder of the hour. And we invite you to join us at 800-486-8655. Or 227-2050, 800-486-8655, and 227-2050. Well, Professor Gates, Jane Gross had to leave us, but some of the issues that she was talking about, I will still be around. If we want to try to get the crystal ball out and take a look into the future, is the fact that that we have as a culture in the United States become more accepting of gays in our culture, does that bode better for the next generation of elderly people in terms of the kind of care and treatment that they can expect as they get older?
Yes, I believe it does. We have a fair bit of evidence to say that people who have a family member or know someone, have a friend or family member or a coworker who they know to be gay or lesbian or bisexual, in general, they tend to be more supportive once they get to know someone. And so to the extent that we're seeing, you know, more and more gay people be visible about the fact that they're gay, it's quite likely that then, you know, the general population will become more accepting. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle. You know, acceptance brings people to be more open, and then their being more open brings more acceptance.
Let's talk about some of the other demographic aspects of your report.
Sure.
One of the things that I think is in some of the detail and has also been reported elsewhere is the traditional so-called gay enclaves in a number of communities are becoming rather passé. People are moving out of them, and they're just integrating with the rest of the population.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's a little bit true, although I actually think the bigger trend is not so much a, you know, a huge kind of migration pattern. I think it's that all the gay people living in the suburbs are just becoming more visible. And so the kind of centrality of these gay neighborhoods in the geographical and perhaps even for some people the kind of psychological community, gay community, isn't as strong as it once was. You know, I think people now are feeling more comfortable to be openly gay outside of the enclaves. I mean, there's still a fair bit of evidence that, you know, when you look at what portion of households are same-sex couples, you still find neighborhoods like the Castro or Chelsea in New York or cities like San Francisco and Key West and Provincetown, you know, among the top-ranked places. But, again, you're also seeing, though, you know, cities like Tampa and Orlando sort of cracking into some of those higher ranked cities, so places not necessarily historically known. And I'm not sure that that's all about a bunch of gay people necessarily leaving Chelsea and moving to Tampa, but it's that, you know, gay people in Florida are being more open all over the state, and in fact, you know, again, gay people all over the country are doing that.
Part of this has to do with development and the cost of housing in certain neighborhoods too,
right.
Doesn't it?
And it's certainly true that, you know, and this is even true in the data, when you look at census data, you find same-sex couples living in neighborhoods that are, you know, somewhat more urban, somewhat more racially and ethnically diverse. They're places that are, have sort of smaller housing stock, you know, typical of urban areas. But, you know, along with that, they also tend to have higher crime rates. And then along with all of that, they have very high property values. So what happens is often, you know, the neighborhood sort of prices itself out, especially for younger people. And so, again, younger people tend to then move further out in the periphery.
We have a caller who wants to join our discussion. Let's talk to Joan in Spooner. Joan, good morning.
Good morning. My comment is, has to do with a film, a short film, a documentary that follows a historic battle of a lieutenant, a dying New Jersey police officer, who fights to transfer her pension to her domestic partner. And it's a cliffhanger because it really is, she's being opposed by the official county officials because they don't want to agree to this transfer of her pension. And they stand firmly against her, and the town explodes around her in support of her. And she has lung cancer, and it's a story of, it's true. I mean, this happened. She's a dedicated police officer for, I don't know, 29 years or something in this town in New Jersey. And it's a race against time to provide for her partner. And it's a fascinating film, and it was something that I think fits in perfectly with your discussion of older couples who are facing health problems.
Well, and in fact, among the same-sex couples, almost a quarter of them are age 55 or older.
Uh-huh. Well, this woman who was had the cancer was not in that.
Okay.
She wasn't that old, but she was. You know, she had been on the police force
right.
for years and was dedicated, and all of her co-workers, the men who had been working with her, she was a detective, that had high praise for her and
right.
came to her defense. The city came. The people just jammed the room, the civic room, to defend her, and it really turned into a real battle and a laugh. Exciting, because
right.
I didn't know how it was going to work out.
Well, and one of the interesting things is that now, I mean, what you point out is one of the challenges that same-sex couples have, in that, you know, oftentimes because they can't get married or have their relationships recognized, things that would just be routine to happen with married couples, like issues of, you know, transferring a pension or something like that, become incredibly difficult for same-sex couples. So, you know, New Jersey now has actually, you know, theoretically remedied some of that. They do have civil unions now in New Jersey, and so same-sex couples can enter into a civil union and are able to then, you know, take advantage of benefits that would normally have been only reserved for heterosexual married couples. But again, you point out that's still only 20% of people in the United States live in a state where same-sex couples have any kind of legal recognition. So, you know, the vast majority of same-sex couples live in areas where they lack those kinds of legal protections.
There's in your survey, states barring legal acceptance of same-sex couples had larger percentage increases in same-sex couples from 2000 to 2006.
That's right.
And the states that had formal recognition of same-sex couples had the lowest average percentage increases. I'm going to make a little bit of an assumption on the latter number, and that is that there were just more people who were out to begin with there.
That's
and
exactly.
So their increase was less.
And I think that's one issue. I also do think that we've had some evidence. You know, when I talk to people in these states that have had ballot initiatives trying to ban same-sex marriage, one of the impacts of that sometimes is that couples who maybe have spent their life being fairly discreet about their relationship for the first time in some of these very conservative states, they start seeing their lives portrayed on the news and, you know, being discussed in, on radio and on television. And some of them, I think, make the decision to say, hey, you know, they're talking about me now, and perhaps they're not getting the story quite right, so I'm going to, you know, become more active and perhaps more open. And so I think that has a factor, you know, that's a factor in those numbers as well.
We're talking with Professor Gary Gates, a senior research fellow at the Williams Institute, the UCLA School of Law, about a recent study that indicates the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quintupled in the last 17 years. And we are discussing what that means and what it suggests about future trends and so forth, and trying to explain the numbers. Let me give a couple of numbers that you can use to join our discussion here this morning. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, that number is 227-2050. 227-2050. Voters in Wisconsin went to the polls in the last election and voted in favor of a constitutional amendment not only banning gay marriage, but civil unions of any kind.
Right.
I didn't specifically look up Wisconsin's numbers, but they were in terms of the number of individuals or the number of couples identifying themselves as same-sex couples. But there was a significant increase in the last 17 years in the upper Midwest as well.
Yes, there was. I mean, the Midwest actually is the area, especially the upper Midwest. One of the factors we tried to look at in the report was to say how much of this is coming out versus some migration patterns, because we know that the population has generally moved into some more conservative areas, like into the South and the mountain areas. And when you kind of take that migration pattern into account, the Midwest is really the upper Midwest in particular is the area where the increases in same-sex couples have been 55 times higher than the increase in the population. So, you know, it's been quite enormous in that region. And I think it's indicative of perhaps, again, some level of social acceptance increasing in the Midwest, but also, as you point out, perhaps some of these initiatives have caused people to say, you know, I need to become more involved.
Let's take a call from Rhonda in Cedarburg. Rhonda, good morning.
Good morning. I am the mother of a 17-year-old daughter who is a lesbian. And I am just very disturbed that what I feel are her constitutional, you know, right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is being denied her in the state.
And in fact, as I said, I mean, in 80% of the country, same-sex couples, you know, have no legal recognition, and certainly in the federal level, they have no recognition. That said, in 20% of the country they do, and that's gone from 0 to 20% in only 5 years.
And not only, you know, our family is a family of atheists and agnostics. So,
right.
You know, to me, this is clearly a question of a group, you know, inserting their religious dogmas onto, you know, the rest of us. And, you know, I just think how, you know, this is obviously a religious issue that, you know, ought to be left to individuals to decide.
But it is interesting, even when you look at, again, these data, it is in some of the parts of the country that are among the most religious parts of the country, again, you're seeing these big increases. And a great example of that is Utah, a state where if you looked at just what percentage of households were a same-sex couple household, in 1990, Utah was ranked 38th out of the 50 states, and it's now 14th. And I don't think it's coincidence then also in Utah that Brigham Young University, which is obviously a very, you know, it's a religious institution, they've now, being gay is no longer a violation of the honor code there. And that might seem like a really small step, but it is fascinating to me that even in these, you know, very religious and very conservative areas, I do think you're, and it's perhaps, you know, for you with a lesbian daughter, perhaps painfully slow, but I think that there is some evidence of change going on, even, and I think you're seeing also this, the kind of political efforts to use gay issues as a wedge to try to motivate religiously conservative people. I think it's that's starting to lose momentum, because I think part of that is because religiously conservative people just aren't as vehement about this issue as they were, you know, 5-10 years ago. And you know, my hope is that another 10 years down the line, that you know, we'll see even less antagonism, you know, from the religious communities.
Rhonda, if you might, you're still on. I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Obviously, your family supports your daughter. What is what's her experience been in school and in the community?
You know, she's out with all of her friends, and it's amazing to me the difference from when I was in school 25 years ago. The support that she's receiving from her friends, straight and gay friends, and it's really becoming, you know, kind of a non-issue for young people. And, you know, I hear them talk about it all the time that, you know, they can't wait until they take over the political reins so that they can just, you know, make this, you know, the law of the land.
Rhonda, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your phone call.
Thank you. Great.
Professor Gates, Rhonda, is Rhonda saying something that you think is going to be a trend as you look into the future, based on the numbers that we're seeing, the increases, people who are willing to self-identify, is being gay going to be a big deal in the future?
Well, you know, again, I think that's something that these numbers are suggesting, that in fact it won't be as big a deal as it is now. You know, we also know, as she pointed out, that younger people are in many ways substantially more supportive of gay people and their rights, or at the very least are not antagonistic. You know, they don't see what the big deal is, as she kind of described her daughter and their friends. And I do think, you know, as that generation, they grew, as Jane pointed out, you know, the straight population in nursing homes grew up in the same kind of oppressive environment as older gay people did, and they all share that kind of common, you know, gay or straight, that common experience of a society that was really uncomfortable with this topic. And I think in younger generations now, you're going to have a situation where kids, you know, both kids that are religious, kids not religious, kids that are Republican families, kids from Democrat families, that they will, their experience of gay people and gay issues is much more nonchalant than, you know, older generations.
Let's go next to Matthew in Madison. Matthew, thanks for calling.
Hello, and thanks for having me on the air. I was calling for one point and one question, and I'll take my question once off the air. The point that I want to make is, you know, Tampa, Orlando, Savannah, Georgia, I've lived in all these places, and they've been really quite open. I mean, this is 10, 15 years ago. The gay community has been really quite out. It's really interesting to hear that the statistics of actually seeing the community speak up about themselves is taking this long, but it's been very open community for living there, great places to go out to eat, places to go out to dance. But my question is, as people grow older, they tend to get more conservative and so forth, and my biggest concern is that there would be a backlash, maybe 10, 15, maybe even 20 years down the road, against the gay community, because they, you know, you give someone rights and then sometimes you feel like you need to take them away. You know, an example is the movement to limit a woman's choice over her own body. And so I have this really fear that, and I just would like to know if that's something that you see.
Well, I think you make a point that I often tell people as well, which is, you know, despite what I just said about younger people having, you know, much more accepting attitudes, I think it's important to remember that, you know, even the current very conservative political leadership right now, a lot of them grew up in the era of the 60s and in fact had embraced a lot of the, you know, sort of sexual revolution principles, or at the very least were not nearly, when they were younger, as conservative as they are now. And so I do think that we have to be a little careful to not just assume that people carry these attitudes with them, you know, through the rest of their lives. You correctly point out, people do become a bit more conservative as they get older, and sometimes become more religious as well. So I think there is that danger. My hope is that it's not an overwhelming problem in the future, but I think there is a need for a certain level of vigilance, to not assume that, as you point out, that granting these rights is something that will just become permanent. I think one of the differences, though, with the sexual orientation issue is that people are coming out across all dimensions of life. You know, I mean, people are coming out in white families, in African American families, in Latino families, in rich families and poor families, in, you know, religiously conservative families and in, you know, atheist families. And so given that, my hope is that that means that there'll be this big cross-section of people who have a very kind of first-hand experience of gay people, and that perhaps that might mute some of that backlash over time.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have some more callers who want to join the discussion. You can be one of those as well if you call us at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. My guest this hour is Gary Gates, Senior Research Fellow at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 before 11. I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up next hour. One of the topics on the menu for Larry Mueller after 11 is the role of scientist as public citizen. His guest is UW-Madison chemistry professor Basham Shakashiri. That's coming up after 11 o'clock this morning with Larry Mueller. This hour we're talking about a study that indicates that the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quintupled in the last 17 years. My guest is Gary Gates, Senior Research Fellow at the Williams Institute, UCLA School of Law. And we have callers who are waiting to join us, so let's go to the phones and talk first to Dave in Marshfield. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. When I listen to these discussions about gays and gay rights, I always reflect back on what I recall as some origins of that. It seems to me that it was 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years ago, legal equality was being talked about as civil rights, or not civil rights, but civil union. And that seemed to be gaining some traction, and then it got to a point where the gay community, it seemed, said, "Now we want to be married, not have a civil union. We want it to be married." And I think what that did was muddy the waters and muddy the discussion between the legal aspect of marriage and the religious aspect of marriage. Historically, those have been mingled because it's always been considered one and the same. But a marriage has certain legal protections, as you know, but it also has religious roots. And I think that if the gay community can accept a civil union that has the same legal rights, and not talk about marriage. If they want to be married, go to their religious institution and get married in the religious institution. They may be able to gain more traction on that. It also may be more acceptable. You know, the justice of the peace, when they were doing marriages, you know, way back when, they were doing a religious ceremony. And I think that we need to separate the two, get a legal contract for two people living together that's issued by the state. You fill out the forms, you pay the fee, and you're in. And if you want to be married, that you do in your religious institution. And I think we need to take some effort to separate those two, and I think separating those two ideas would also unify the whole, you know, people on both sides of the divide. Any comments?
I think you point out something that's a fairly large topic of debate, even within, you know, gay political strategy, to how do you, you know, what's the right way to get the kind of legal rights, but also the coupled with that sort of the social recognition. And that's where there's a bit of a tension, because we, as you correctly point out, you know, there are a whole set of legal rights, and theoretically you could remedy that with a civil union. But marriage also has this kind of social status as well, and it's because it's marriage. It's literally that word and that institution. And so I think there's a big struggle that people wrestle with, you know, of that balance between wanting the civil rights, or does equality also extend beyond just simple legal rights to, you know, this dignity associated with marriage. Another idea that a lot of people float is to just completely disestablish marriage from government. So essentially what you say, what you point out, the civil union, that would be all couples, gay or straight, would do that. And if gay or straight couples want to get married, they would go to a religious community and get married, or even a non-religious community and get married. But that on the state level, you know, you create a civil union that's everybody. I think as a society, you know, that right now doesn't have much traction. However, it's absolutely true that broadly people are much more comfortable with civil unions than marriage for same-sex couples. And in that case, you know, sense, it, you know, on a pure kind of political basis, you might very well be right. I think the challenge is that, you know, gay people do view this as a civil rights issue, and they see marriage as something beyond simply a set of legal rights, and that has a kind of inherent dignity that then the state is not granting to them. And, you know, that's the struggle that's out there.
Well, I don't want to turn this into a discussion about the gay marriage issue, because we covered that quite extensively last year during the run-up to the election. But isn't it true, historically, marriage has been a civil function? It's been a legal function of the state and not of the church. And it's only really been in the last several hundred years that it's become a major church function.
Yeah, I mean, the history of marriage is actually quite complex. And the problem is, depending on what sort of cultural reference you choose, you know, marriage, as you point out, I mean, there's a very kind of mixed, and there's been an intermingling of church and state, you know, through a lot of it. And it's very, very difficult to easily disentangle that.
Well, we've got about a little less than 2 minutes left, so I'm a little hesitant to open us up to any new questions. But what I want to talk about as we finish up here this morning is where you go next with this kind of study. Now you've got a chance to get statistics on a yearly basis. What's your plan? What happens next?
The next big thing is to track more than just the counts. So it's to begin to look at trends in characteristics of same-sex couples, so things like child rearing. One of the most surprising things from the 2000 census was finding that that one in four same-sex couples were raising children, and certainly anecdotally, it seems like, you know, we're the visibility of gay people with children has increased fairly dramatically. So it's to begin to track that and see if the numbers sort of, you know, reflect what we're seeing anecdotally. So look at child rearing, look at other kinds of demographic characteristics, race and ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and to begin to look at those things over time rather than just at these, you know, 10-year intervals. So that's sort of where the next big paper that we're trying to work on with these data is going.
And perhaps the biggest question of all, and I'm only going to give you 30 seconds to respond, and I realize this isn't fair, but what does all this mean?
Well, I think it means, again, that there's a lot of the gay population is becoming increasingly more visible. And as they become visible, they're changing because the people coming out are coming out, in conservative parts of the country, and perhaps many of them hold those kinds of conservative values as well, and simultaneously are perhaps changing some of those conservative values where they live. So I think the political climate, this has a potential effect on the political climate to the degree that it can use these kinds of gay issues in the manner that they've been used, certainly in the past few election cycles. I think we're seeing that might be changing.
And that seems like a good place to leave it. Gary Gates, right. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Gary Gates, Senior Research Fellow, the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning with on-air production by John Tretter. I'm John Munson. In for Kathleen Dunn, this is the Ideas Network.